S wouldn't have known what a collective noun was if it had spat in her eye. But she knew there was a herd of goats and a coven of witches. She didn't know what you called a lot of wizards. An order of wizards? A conspiracy? A circle? Whatever it was, it filled the university. Wizards strolled among the cloisters and sat on benches under the trees. Young wizards scuttled along pathways as bells rang, with their arms full of books, or, in the case of senior students, with their books flapping through the air after them. The air had the greasy feel of magic and tasted of tin. Esk walked along between Treacle and Simon and drank it all in. It wasn't just that there was magic in the air, but it was tamed and working, like a mill race. It was power, but it was harnessed. Simon was as excited as she was, but it showed only because his eyes watered more and his stutter got worse. He kept stopping to point out various colleges and research buildings. One was quite low and brooding, with high, narrow windows.
That's the library, said Simon, his voice bursting with wonder and respect. Can I have a look?
Plenty of time for that later, said Treacle. Simon gave the building a wistful look.
Books of magic ever written,
he whispered.
Why are the windows barred? Said Esk.
Simon swallowed.
Books of magic aren't like other books. They lead a...
That's enough, snapped Treacle. He looked down at Esk, as if he had just noticed her, and frowned.
Why are you here?
You invited me in, said Esk.
Me? Oh, yes, of course. Sorry, mind wandering. The young lady who wants to be a wizard.
Let us see, shall we? He led the way up a broad flight of steps to an impressive pair of doors. At least, they were designed to be impressive. The designer had invested deeply in heavy locks, curling hinges, brass studs, and an intricately carved archway to make it absolutely clear to anyone entering that they were not very important people at all. He was a wizard. He had forgotten the door knocker. Treacle rapped on the door with his staff. It hesitated for a while, and then slowly slid back its bolts and swung open. The hall was full of wizards and boys' parents. There are two ways of getting into Unseen University. In fact, there are three, but at this time wizards hadn't realized it. The first is to achieve some great work of magic, such as the recovery of an ancient and powerful relic, or the invention of a totally new spell, but in these times it was seldom done. In the past, there had been great wizards capable of forming whole new spells from the chaotic, raw magic of the world. Wizards from whom, as it were, all the spells of wizardry had flowed, but those days had gone. There were no more sorcerers. So the more typical method was to be sponsored by a senior and respected wizard, after a suitable period of apprenticeship. Competition was stiff for a university place, and the honour and privileges an unseen degree could bring. Many of the boys milling around the hall and launching minor spells at each other would fail, and have to spend their lives as lowly magicians, mere magical technologists, with defiant beards and leather patches on their elbows, who congregated in small, jealous groups at parties. Not for them the coveted pointy hat with optional astrological symbols, or the impressive robes, or the staff of authority. But at least they could look down on conjurers, who tended to be jolly and fat, and inclined to drop their H's and drink beer, and go around with sad, thin women in spangly tights, and really infuriate magicians by not realizing how lowly they were, and kept telling them jokes. Lowliest of all, apart from witches, of course, were thaumaturgists, who never got any schooling at all. A thaumaturgist could just about be trusted to wash out an alembic. Many spells required things like mould from a corpse dead of crushing, or the semen of a living tiger, or the root of a plant that gave an ultrasonic scream when it was uprooted. Who was sent to get them? Right. It is a common error to refer to the lower magical ranks as hedge wizards. In fact, hedge wizardry is a very honoured and specialised form of magic that attracts silent, thoughtful men of druidical persuasion and topiric inclinations. If you invited a hedge wizard to a party, he would spend half the evening talking to your potted plant, and he would spend the other half listening. Esk noticed that there were some women in the hall, because even young wizards had mothers and sisters. Whole families had turned up to bid the favoured sons farewell. There was a considerable blowing of noses, wiping of tears, and the clink of coins as proud fathers tucked a little spending money into their offspring's hands. Very senior wizards were perambulating among the crowds, talking to the sponsoring wizards and examining the prospective students. Several of them pushed through the throng to meet Treacle, moving like gold-trimmed galleons under full sail. They bowed gravely to him and looked approvingly at Simon.
"This is young Simon, is it?"
said the fattest of them, beaming at the boy.
"We've had great reports of you, young man. Eh, what?"
Simon bowed to the Arch-Chancellor Cutangle, Arch-Mage of the Wizards of the Silver Star, said Treacle. Simon bowed apprehensively. Cutangle looked at him benevolently.
"We've heard great things about you, my boy," he said. "All this mountain air must be good for the brain, eh?"
He laughed. The wizards around him laughed. Treacle laughed, which Esk thought was rather funny, because there wasn't anything particularly amusing happening.
"From what we hear, it must be the only thing you don't know, lad,"
said Cutangle, his jowls waggling. There was another carefully timed bout of laughter. Cutangle patted Simon on the shoulder.
"This is the scholarship boy," he said. "Quite astounding results. Never seen better. Self-taught, too. Astonishing, what? Isn't that so, Treacle?"
"Superb, Arch-Chancellor." Cutangle looked around at the watching wizards.
"Perhaps you could give us an example," he said. "A little demonstration, perhaps."
Simon looked at him in animal panic.
Actually, I'm not very... Now,
said Cutangle, in what he probably really did think was an encouraging tone of voice.
"Do not be afraid. Take your time. When you are ready..."
Simon licked his dry lips and gave Treacle a look of mute appeal. He said. He stopped and swallowed hard. His eyes bulged, the tears streamed from his eyes, and his shoulders heaved. Treacle patted him reassuringly on the back. "Hay fever," he explained. "Don't seem to be able to cure it. Tried everything." Simon swallowed and nodded. He waved Treacle away with his long white hands and closed his eyes. For a few seconds nothing happened. He stood with his lips moving soundlessly. Then silence spread out from him like candlelight. Ripples of noiselessness washed across the crowds in the hall, striking the walls with all the force of a blown kiss, then curling back in waves. People watched their companions mouthing silently, then went red with effort when their own laughter was as audible as a gnat's squeak. Tiny motes of light winked into existence around his head. They whirled and spiraled in a complex three-dimensional dance and then formed a shape. In fact, it seemed to Esk that the shape had been there all the time, waiting for her eyes to see it, in the same way that a perfectly innocent cloud can suddenly become, without changing in any way, a whale, or a ship, or a face. The shape around Simon's head was the world. That was clear, although the glitter and rush of the little lights blurred some of the detail. But there was great Artuan the sky turtle, with the four elephants on its back, and on them the disk itself. There was the sparkle of the great waterfall around the edge of the world. And there at the very hub, a tiny needle of rock that was the great mountain Cori Celesti, where the gods lived. The image expanded and homed in on the Circle Sea, and then on Ankh itself, the little lights flowing away from Simon and winking out of existence a few feet from his head. Now they showed the city from the air, rushing towards the watchers. There was the university itself, growing larger. There was the great hall. There were the people, watching, silent, open-mouthed, and Simon himself, outlined in specks of silver light, and a tiny sparkling image in the air around him, and that image contained an image, and another, and another. There was a feeling that the universe had been turned inside out in all dimensions at once. It was a bloated, swollen sensation. It sounded as if the whole world had said gloop. The walls faded. So did the floor. The paintings of former great mages, all scrolls and beards and slightly constipated frowns, vanished. The tiles underfoot, a rather nice black and white pattern, evaporated, to be replaced by fine sand, grey as moonlight and cold as ice. Strange and unexpected stars glittered overhead. On the horizon were low hills, eroded not by wind or rain in this weatherless place, but by the soft sandpaper of time itself. No one else seemed to have noticed. No one else, in fact, seemed alive. Esk was surrounded by people as still and silent as statues. And they weren't alone. There were other things behind them, and more were appearing all the time. They had no shape, or rather they seemed to be taking their shapes at random from a variety of creatures. They gave the impression that they had heard about arms and legs and jaws and claws and organs, but didn't really know how they all fitted together, or didn't care, or were so hungry that they hadn't bothered to find out. They made a sound like a swarm of flies. They were the creatures out of her dreams, come to feed on magic. She knew they weren't interested in her now, except in the nature of an after-dinner mint. Their whole concentration was focused on Simon, who was totally unaware of their presence. Esk kicked him smartly on the ankle. The cold desert vanished. The real world rushed back. Simon opened his eyes, smiled faintly, and gently fell backwards into Esk's arms. A buzz went up from the wizards, and several of them started to clap. No one seemed to have noticed anything odd, apart from the silver lights. Cutangle shook himself and raised a hand to quell the crowd.
"Quite astonishing," he said to Treacle. "You say he worked it out all by himself?"
"Indeed, Lord."
"No one helped him at all?"
"There was no one to help him," said Treacle.
"He was just wandering from village to village doing small spells, but only if people paid him in books or paper."
Cutangle nodded.
"It was no illusion," he said. "Yet he didn't use his hands. What was he saying to himself, do you know?"
"He says it's just words to make his mind work properly," said Treacle, and shrugged. "I can't understand half of what he says, and that's a fact. He says he's having to invent words because there aren't any for the things he's doing."
Cutangle glanced sideways at his fellow mages. They nodded.
"It will be an honour to admit him to the university," he said. "Perhaps you would tell him so when he wakes up."
He felt a tugging at his robe and looked down.
"Excuse me," said Esk.
"Hello, young lady,"
said Cutangle in a sugar mouse voice.
"Have you come to see your brother enter the university?"
"He's not my brother," said Esk. There were times when the world had seemed to be full of brothers, but this wasn't one of them.
Are you important? She said. Cutangle looked at his colleagues and beamed. There were fashions in wizardry, just like anything else. Sometimes wizards were thin and gaunt and talked to animals. The animals didn't listen, but it's the thought that counts. While at other times they tended towards the dark or saturnine, with little black pointed beards. Currently, Alder Manic was in. Cutangle swelled with modesty.
"Quite important," he said. "One does one's best in the service of one's fellow man."
"Yes, quite important, I would say."
"I want to be a wizard," said Esk. The lesser wizards behind Cutangle stared at her as if she was a new and interesting kind of beetle. Cutangle's face went red and his eyes bulged. He looked down at Esk and seemed to be holding his breath. Then he started to laugh. It started somewhere down in his extensive stomach regions and worked its way up, echoing from rib to rib and causing minor wizard quakes across his chest until it burst forth in a series of strangled snorts. It was quite fascinating to watch, that laugh. It had a personality all of its own. But he stopped when he saw Esk's stare. If the laugh was a music hall clown, then Esk's determined squint was a whitewash bucket on a fast trajectory.
"A wizard," he said. "You want to be a wizard?"
"Yes," said Esk, pushing the dazed Simon into Treacle's reluctant arms. "I'm the eighth son of an eighth son. I mean, daughter." The wizards around her were looking at one another and whispering. Esk tried to ignore them.
"What did she say?" "Is she serious?" "I always think children are so delightful at that age, don't you?" "You're the eighth son of an eighth daughter," said Cutangle. "Really?"
"The other way around, only not exactly," said Esk defiantly. Cutangle dabbed his eyes with a handkerchief.
"This is quite fascinating," he said. "I don't think I've ever heard of something quite like this before, eh?"
He looked around at his growing audience. The people at the back couldn't see Esk and were craning to check if some interesting magic was going on. Cutangle was at a loss.
"Well, now," he said, "you want to be a wizard."
"I keep telling everyone, but no one seems to listen," said Esk.
"How old are you, little girl?"
"Nearly 9.
"And you want to be a wizard when you grow up?"
"I want to be a wizard now," said Esk firmly. "This is the right place, isn't it?" Cutangle looked at Treacle and winked. "I saw that," said Esk.
"I don't think there's ever been a lady wizard before," said Cutangle. "I rather think it might be against the law. Wouldn't you rather be a witch? I understand it's a fine career for girls."
A minor wizard behind him started to laugh. Esk gave him a look. "Being a witch is quite good," she conceded. "But I think wizards have more fun. What do you think?"
"I think you're a very singular little girl," said Cutangle.
"What does that mean?"
"It means there's only one of you," said Treacle.
"That's right," said Esk. "And I still want to be a wizard."
Words failed Cutangle. "Well, you can't," he said. "The very idea."
He drew himself up to his full width and turned away. Something tugged at his robe.
"Why not?"
said a voice. He turned.
"Because,"
he said, slowly and deliberately,
"because the whole idea is completely laughable, that's why. And it's absolutely against the law."
"But I can do wizard magic," said Esk, the faintest suggestion of a tremble in her voice.
Cutangle bent down until his face was level with hers.
"No, you can't," he hissed, "because you're not a wizard. Women aren't wizards. Do I make myself clear?"
Watch,
said Esk. She extended her right hand with the fingers spread and sighted along until she spotted the statue of Malik the Wise, the founder of the university. Instinctively, the wizards between her and it edged out of the way and then felt rather silly.
I mean it, she said.
Go away, little girl, said Q-Tangle.
Right, said Esk.
She squinted hard at the statue and concentrated. The great doors of Unseen University are made of Octoron, a metal so unstable that it can only exist in a universe saturated with raw magic. They are impregnable to all force save magic. No fire, no battering ram, no army can breach them. Which is why most ordinary visitors to the university use the back door, which is made of perfectly normal wood and doesn't go around terrorizing people. Or even stand still terrorizing people. It had a proper knocker and everything. Granny examined the doorposts carefully and gave a grunt of satisfaction when she spotted what she was looking for. She hadn't doubted that it would be there, cunningly concealed by the natural grain of the wood. She grasped the knocker, which was shaped like a dragon's head, and rapped smartly three times. After a while, the door was opened by a young woman with her mouth full of clothes pegs.
What do you want?
She inquired. Granny bowed, giving the girl a chance to take in the pointy black hat and the batwing hatpins. It had an impressive effect. She blushed, and, peering out into the quiet alleyway, hurriedly motioned Granny inside. There was a big mossy courtyard on the other side of the wall, criss-crossed with washing lines. Granny had the chance to become one of the very few women to learn what it really is that wizards wear under their robes, but modestly averted her eyes and followed the girl across the flagstones and down a wide flight of steps. They led into a long, high tunnel lined with archways and currently full of steam. Granny caught sight of long lines of washtubs in the big rooms off to the sides. The air had the warm, fat smell of ironing. A gaggle of girls carrying wash baskets pushed past her and hurried up the steps. They stopped halfway up and turned slowly to look at her. Granny set her shoulders back and tried to look as mysterious as possible. Her guide, who still hadn't got rid of her clothes pegs, led her down a side passage into a room that was a maze of shelves piled with laundry. In the very centre of the maze, sitting at a table, was a very fat woman with a ginger wig. She had been writing in a very large laundry book. It was still open in front of her, but was currently inspecting a large stained vest.
"Have you tried bleaching?" she asked.
"Yes'm," said the maid beside her.
"What about tincture of myrrh?"
"Yes'm, it just turned it blue."
"Well, this is a new one on me," said the laundry woman. "And I've seen brimstone and soot and dragon blood and demon blood and I don't know what else."
She turned the vest over and read the name tape carefully sewn inside.
Grandpern the White. He's going to be Grandpern the Grey if he doesn't take better care of his laundry. I tell you, girl, a white magician is just a black magician with a good housekeeper. Take it."
She caught sight of Granny and stopped.
"It's up at the wall,"
said Granny's guide, dropping a hurried curtsy.
"Who is that?"
"Yes, yes, thank you, Cassandra, you may go,"
said the fat woman, and stood up and beamed at Granny, and with an almost perceptible click wound her voice up several social classes.
"Pray excuse us," she said. "You'll find us all at sixes and sevens, it being washing day and everything. Is this a courtesy call, or may I make so bold as to ask," she lowered her voice, "is there a message from the other side?"
Granny looked blank, but only a fraction of a second. The witch marks on the doorpost had said that the housekeeper welcomed witches and was particularly anxious for news of her four husbands. She was also in random pursuit of a fifth, hence the ginger wig, and if Granny's ears weren't deceiving her, the creak of enough whalebone to infuriate an entire ecology movement. Gullible and foolish, the signs had said. Granny withheld judgment because city witches didn't seem that bright themselves. The housekeeper must have mistaken her expression.
"Don't be afraid," she said. "My staff have distinct instructions to welcome witches, although, of course, they upstairs don't approve. No doubt you would like a cup of tea and something to eat."
Granny bowed solemnly.
"And I will see if we can't find a nice bundle of old clothes for you, too."
The housekeeper beamed.
"Old clothes? Oh, yes. Thank you, ma'am."
The housekeeper swept forward with a sound like an elderly tea clipper in a gale, and beckoned Granny to follow her.
"Have the tea brought to my flat. Tea with a lot of tea leaves."
Granny stumped along after her.
"Old clothes? Did this fat woman really mean it? The nerve!"
Of course, if they were good quality, there seemed to be a whole world under the university. It was a maze of cellars, cauldrons, still rooms, kitchens and sculleries, and every inhabitant was either carrying something, pumping something, pushing something, or standing around and just shouting. Granny caught glimpses of rooms full of ice, and others glowing with the heat from red-hot cooking stoves, wall-sized. Bakeries smelled of new bread, and taprooms smelled of old beer. Everything smelled of sweat and wood smoke. The housekeeper led her up an old spiral staircase and unlocked the door with one of the large number of keys that hung from her belt. The room inside was pink and frilly. There were frills on things that no one in their right mind would frill. It was like being inside candy floss.
"Very nice," said Granny,
and because she felt it was expected of her,
"tasteful."
She looked around for something unfrilly to sit on and gave up.
"Whatever am I thinking of?"
the housekeeper trilled.
"I'm Mrs. Whitlow, what I expect you know, of course. And I have the honour to be addressing..."
Granny Weatherwax," said Granny.
The frills were getting to her. They gave Pink a bad name.
"I'm psychic myself, of course," said Mrs. Whitlow.